So I'm going to spend the next little bit before lunch talking about mixing. This is the fourth of the geodynamics lectures, basically, and it's about dispersion of heterogeneities in the Earth. And I'm starting out by talking... Oh, we have laser pointer. Good. Okay. So I started out with this picture. This is one of the kind of classic canonical pictures of mixing. It is not a mantle convection model at all. But this was done by a group headed by Otino, who is an engineer and physicist who works on mixing processes. He's actually moved on now from fluid mechanics to more granular flow because there's some interesting problems there. And so you'll oftentimes when you see people talk about mixing, you'll see one of these pictures or a picture very much like it. This is a tank of fluid, and he is driving it with an oscillating flow, basically an oscillating surface boundary condition. It's just moving back and forth there. And then he's injected these fluorescent dyes, one into this region. It probably started out as a blob like that, and one in this, a green fluorescent dye and a red fluorescent dye. And what you're seeing is basically folding and mixing in this region, and then this other region where there's not much going on. And this is a problem for engineers, because if you want to make something that has, engineering-wise, well-mixed. If you want to inject a dye into a plastic, for example, and then homogenize the plastic, that's a problem for you. It's a problem for us for other reasons. We want to understand whether these things, such things occur in the Earth. This is a rough outline of the talk. I'm basically going to start out by, although these two parts are going to be sort of interspersed, I'm going to talk at the beginning just briefly about why we are interested in this problem in general, in the mantle. I'm going to stick to the mantle and not so much the core because of my own lack of knowledge about mixing in the core, but I think there may be some interesting problems in the core. And then I'm going to just introduce some very basic physics of mixing, and then we'll talk about mixing the mantle, and I'm going to go through a sort of sampling of different methods that have been used to study mixing. And I don't intend this to be comprehensive, but to give you an idea of the range of methodologies that are used to study mixing. And I'm going to leave open a lot of questions, because there are a lot of open questions. And actually, there are some things in this kind of problem that I think could make productive research projects for next week. So I'm going to leave a bunch of things open. Okay, so first, why do we care? Well, Stan's talk last week and some of the other talks talked about sort of scales of heterogeneity as we observe them in the mantle. And so what we want to do is basically understand the origins of these heterogeneities. And these are two pictures taken from the literature from the geochemical literature that essentially illustrate this point. The top plot here is redrawn from a review paper by Farley and Naroda on helium isotope distributions in the Earth. And basically, it's a histogram of 3-4 isotopes, 3-4 measurements. Remember that helium-3 is supposed to be representative of some less degassed material, or high helium-3-4 is supposed to be representative of that. This was a review paper done in 1998, and so there's more data now and different sort of a more complete understanding of this. But the basic idea here is that basically we have the number of measurements and the helium-3, helium-4 ratio normalized to the atmospheric ratio. So this scale is a little bit arbitrary, but it's a useful scale for us. The idea is that there's a fair amount of scatter worldwide in the ocean island basalts, and we have some ocean islands that have very high 3-4 ratios and some that have low 3-4 ratios and then a bunch in the middle. So there's a lot of heterogeneity when you look at ocean island basalts in this kind of isotopic system. And because helium-4 is a product of the decay of uranium and thorium, it takes time to develop that spectrum of heterogeneity. You can't do it all at once by some chemical process. It has to be done by a decay process. So that's the important point to remember there in a general sort of way. Then if we look at the mid-ocean ridge basalts worldwide, we find that they are this is basically sort of normal morph, so-called normal morph. So we find that they fall into a much more narrow range. This isn't really a histogram, it's just a range because there are many, many, many samples. But they basically fall, roughly speaking, centered around a value of 8. And so what we find is that the mid-ocean ridges are sampling a portion of the mantle that appears from this plot to be relatively homogeneous compared to the ocean islands. And so that's a thing we have to explain. That's a constraint on the mantle that we have to understand. Okay, so that's a kind of global scale picture. The global isotopic tetrahedron that Stan put up last week also gives you a similar kind of idea of the scope of heterogeneity in the mantle and the time scale that it takes to develop that. If we look locally, let's just look at a single ocean island basalt. This is a paper from Bill White's group. I'm afraid I can't remember the first author. I guess I'm embarrassed to say. But they took, this is from the Galapagos Islands. They took a number of samples. So this is an ocean island that sits fairly near a mid-ocean ridge. And they took a number of samples, and then they contoured them. So what you're seeing here is a contour of 87, 86 strontium and neodymium isotopes. And just all I want you to do is really look at the range of contours here and notice that there is a wide range of values in this very small region. So the point of this putting this plot up, of me, a geophysicist, putting this geochemical map up, is to say that there is a wide spectrum of heterogeneity, even seen at a very fine scale, even at the sort of, you know, local scale in the mantle, as represented by this particular island. And this is somewhat characteristic as well of a variety of locations around the world. So we have a global scale of heterogeneity of some sort, also some homogeneity in the mid-ocean ridges, and then we have a some sort of more regional scale heterogeneity as well. Okay, so I'm going to bring up, I when I was preparing this talk, it gave me a chance to go back and look at some classic papers, and I'm bringing them up because some of them have become iconic papers, and maybe that means that people don't always go back and read what they originally said. So I'm going to show you a series of older work that is relevant to this problem. This is a paper by Claude Alleg and Don Turcotte from Nature, 1986, and they looked at a couple of things. We're going to look at this part of the paper now, and then I'll bring back another part later. They proposed that the scale of heterogeneity in the mantle goes all the way down to the centimeter scale. And they looked, or they took some measurements that had been made of peroxenite layers in a peritotite, a mantle peritotite. This is just a diagram of that, in which essentially there's sort of the stretching and folding, very similar to the Otino picture that I showed you in the first slide. Lots of stretching and folding. They hypothesized that this might be ancient subducted oceanic crust that has been stretched and thinned from 6 kilometer scale to the centimeter scale, and then has appeared back up, has been placed into the crust where we can map it now. And they took some measurements of this and looked at the number the number of bands here that are of a given thickness and plotted basically a distribution of those bands, and noticed that they fell along. This is on a log-log plot, so they saw that they fell along this range, and that you can fit this kind of plot to them, and basically it amounts to a fractal distribution of heterogeneity. And so they suggested that this might be this might be the end point, the final kind of last stage of homogenization in the mantle. And they called it, they had a name, they called it a marble cake mantle. So sorry to put this up before lunch from this great scientific journal, epicurious.com. We have a marble cake. So the idea of the marble cake is basically that you mix in some of the chocolate and the vanilla, and you have a two-reservoir mantle that is stirred, but incompletely stirred, so that you can get very, very fine bands and then bigger sort of bands. I like this picture partly because it allows me to show that the two-dimensional view, which is represented by the surface of the cheesecake, is different from the three-dimensional view. And so when we move from 2D to 3D in the mantle, we're also going to find that there's some complexity added to the problem.
Is that a subduction zone in the upper left?
Yes. Well, yes, it is. Okay. All right. So remember that distribution of heterogeneities. And so I put this up here. Where's Alan? Are you planning to show this later?
Well, after you showed the Allegro, I thought I might, yeah.
Okay, so I won't try and explain it exactly then, but basically, what this is a paper by Alan Levander, and I think Cinti Lee is on this, is a co-author of this, and there's a group of people who are co-authors on this, in which they were looking at scales. They were using this snorkel experiment to detect scales of heterogeneity in the upper mantle at the scale of, you know, kilometers to tens of kilometers. They're attempting to do that. And they have a couple of measurements which indicate the sort of frequency of the occurrence of those heterogeneities and then the magnitude of the heterogeneity. And they noticed that when they plotted these on the same scale as the marble cake mantle paper, that everything falls along this line in spite of the fact that we're moving over many, many orders of magnitude of thickness in scale. So this is intriguing. This is basically a mantle scale process here, or mantle scale observation of structure, and then this is a sort of a field sample to hand sample size scale of structure, both of which may represent the scales of heterogeneity in the mantle, and they seem to fall along this same line in terms of frequency. That would basically be the number of bands, and then the thickness of bands. That's the log
of
kilometers.
If you actually, though, just took Allegra and Turcotte's line,
yeah,
and extrapolated it, you would miss by...
Yeah, you might miss. That's right. Yeah.
As a different exponent.
Yes, you're talking about doing that.
Yeah.
What are the big red dots?
The big red dots are two observations of frequency of occurrence of bands and the scale of those bands from seismic observations of the upper mantle. Is that correct?
Yes.
Simplified? Okay. And if you want to know any more detail about that, ask Alan. This is his work. So, okay, so I'm basically putting these things out there as a way of sort of talking about why we want to know about the scale of heterogeneity in the mantle. We want to know what it's telling us, what these sorts of observations are telling us. We want to know if we can explain both the seismic observations of scales of heterogeneity and also the geochemical observations of the scales of heterogeneity. And so that's where geodynamics comes in. So let's move to what the basic processes are that control mixing. And I mentioned this guy Otino because he's done a lot of work and he's written a book about kinematics of mixing, which is a little bit challenging to adapt to our kind of problem, but it does outline the basic processes, and he also has some review papers that are kind of useful, that can be useful. But a lot of what I want to say about the basics of mixing is encompassed in this particular diagram. So essentially, when we're talking about mixing, any flow that happens in a fluid is going to deform things. In a viscous fluid, we're going to have deformation. We're going to have shearing. If any of you took structural geology, you learned about shearing and so on. So this occurs in any kind of continuum flow. If we start with a blob, in this case green, embedded in a fluid that is yellow here, how are we going to homogenize this or mix this or stir it? Well, the way to do that is basically the two elements of stirring are stretching and folding. So we basically have to elongate that sphere, that circle, and thin it, and then we have to bring it back around to... we have to fold it again to bring it back around in order to mix the two materials. So there's an element of this that is stretching, and then there's an element of this is folding. And so you can think of a lot of mechanical mixing processes. The classic one that people talk about is a taffy pull, where a taffy pulling machine, I don't know if you've ever been on a beach boardwalk and seen a taffy pulling machine, but basically to mix the flavoring and the coloring into the taffy pull, there's a big machine that stretches the sugary stuff and folds it back together, stretching, folding, and that gradually creates a series of narrow bands that gradually mix the flavoring into the surrounding material. Okay, so that one component of this is that in order to have homogenization, you have to bring some of this material. This may not have stayed there, may have gone all over there and come back around. You have to bring it back to its original starting position, but not everything. You have to have stretching and folding. Ultimately, this can go on down to a very, very small scale, and you'll still be able to see bands if you can sample at this very, very small scale. And so the final stage in mixing is basically molecular diffusion, which is represented by these fuzzy boundaries in which the green and the yellow dye are finally mixed together by diffusive processes. And so you might ask yourself, and we will ask ourselves, at what scale does this happen in the Earth? How relevant is this process to the Earth versus this process to the Earth? Something to keep in mind as we move forward. Another thing to keep in mind as we move forward is that this nice kind of cartoonish illustration is not taking into account variations in the properties, potential variations in the properties between the green material and the yellow material. And if the green material and the yellow material have different properties, then there will be a certain amount of, then we can have other things happen. For example, we can have breakup of this into chunks of material that then float around that may or may not be deformed. If this material is stronger than the surrounding material, you may find that it breaks into blobs. If it's weaker, something else may happen. If there is surface tension between these two fluids, this formation of droplets is likely to happen. The question of surface tension between two materials is really not relevant to the mantle, but it is relevant to a lot of experiments, sort of analogies that we use. So I often hear people describe mantle convection by analogy to a lava lamp or something. Well, a lava lamp has a very strong rheological contour, if you've ever looked at one. Every geodynamicist, I bet every geodynamicist in this room has a lava lamp on their desk. So a lava lamp, if you ever watch it go, it has a waxy kind of stuff, and then it has a liquidy kind of stuff. And there's clearly some surface tension going on between them, because as the lava, the so-called lava rises, it forms balls, basically. And that's due to the contrast in viscosity, contrast in rheological properties, and it's also due to the surface tension between these things. So that's not going to be applying to mantle scale processes. Similarly, we often use analogies like mixing cream into coffee to talk about mixing, and that at the sort of finest scale is dominated by diffusion and by turbulence, and those are not necessarily relevant to the mantle, or they're relevant on a different scale in the mantle than they are in a coffee cup. And so we have to be somewhat careful in how we use those analogs to describe what's happening. Okay, so I'm going to show you this film clip, which is a simplified, very simplified model of a convection. I won't even call it mantle convection, but it's a simplified model inspired by mantle convection, in which we have a single box, a flat two-dimensional earth, and this is heated from within, and we have some particles there. They started out here. I put the arrows on there because you're quickly going to lose track of where they started, but they started about where the laser beam is hitting right now. There were 300,000 particles in there, and they started out as a single dot. And what I'm doing is illustrating the stretching. There's the stretching happening, and there's the folding happening. So those are some of the basic processes of mixing. There's a couple of reasons to show this to you. One is that it illustrates that important role of stretching. And the other thing is, since this is about boundary layers, it illustrates the importance of the boundary layer, the role that the boundary layer plays in homogenization. So in this particular model, there is no heating from below, only heating by what amounts to radioactive decay in the interior. And it's a constant rate of heating. I'm not letting the heat production decay with time. It's a constant rate of heating. But it's being heated from within, and that's why this red hot stuff is here, and there's no thermal boundary layer at the bottom. It's being cooled from above, and so there is a thermal boundary layer at the top, and you can see these boundary layer instabilities forming, dropping down, and then getting sort of stirred up. So there's no major return flow. So by the end of this run, essentially those particles have been not completely dispersed, but fairly well dispersed throughout this entire system. And they are dispersed by the stretching and thinning. So again, I'm just going to let this run for a little bit longer. Now we've looped back around. You can see a lot of the stretching happens right at that corner where the downwelling occurs. And then we actually get some anti-stretching as it sort of, the blob kind of comes back together. Then it tries again. We get a little stretching again. It's still not clear that this is ever going to mix in this.
Who is in the particles are independent of each other?
Yes, they
don't have any cohesive force.
There's no stickiness to the particles. That's right. There's no stickiness. They are purely passive tracers. It's as if we just threw some beads in there that had no properties whatsoever. There's no buoyancy with them. There's no viscosity with them. They're just kind of in there. And then they finally get caught up in two downwellings and then stretch completely, and now there's no going back.
So what's the overturn time scale here, roughly? How many, if we scale this to the Earth, how long would it take to make
it? This would be billions of years, many billions of years, I think.
Why does the thickness of the band not usually get thinner? I mean, it's like,
yes.
Around the tiny dot, and then there's a huge.
Yes, right. That's basically because just in order to be able, the dots stay the same size. They are infinitesimal in the calculation, but they are the same. They are a constant size on the plot. If they were really infinitesimal, you wouldn't be able to see them. So they have to be one pixel on the computer screen. And so that one pixel, basically, when you have 300,000 pixels kind of right on top of each other, it looks tiny. And when you have 300,000 pixels all over the place, it looks like a lot more. So that's just an optical illusion, essentially. So there's several things about this that I think are interesting. One is that I kind of like this way of doing flow visualization, actually, in terms of the question of mixing, because it you see different things. You sort of notice different kind of properties, different features happening when you're looking at the particles than when you're looking just at the temperature. It looks like, it doesn't look like much is happening here. It doesn't look like things are moving very much, but there's sort of these things merged. But there's really a lot happening. There's a lot of flowing going on, and there's a lot of stretching going on. So that's one thing that makes this useful, independent of the mixing. The other thing is that at the very end, you may have noticed that there was kind of local homogenization was pretty good within a region. There was this particles were very well distributed, but they were not perfectly distributed uniformly. There were a lot more of them off to the left than there were to the right. And so that suggests that the scales of mixing depend a little bit on the scales of the flow. And in this case, there's a kind of overall wavelength of this convection model that's about an aspect ratio 1 or square root of 2 or something. And it's time dependent, so it varies. But essentially, the particles stay more in their area, and then they gradually drift away. So there is a kind of global scale of mixing that's slower than the local scale of mixing, if that makes sense. All right. Have you seen that enough? Okay. I'm never sure. It's kind of mesmerizing. It may sort of put people into a little trance or something. Okay, so when we first did it, we actually had music to it, because when we first were doing this, there was early stages in kind of computer animation, and you couldn't control the speed of these things, so the computer would slow down or speed up as it was displaying it, and then if you tack a music track to it, then the computer knows that that's what it needs. I think QuickTime has gotten a little smarter since then. Okay, so this is also redrawn actually from a paper by Otino that talks about sort of different mixing in different applications. And I just think it's interesting because of where geophysics falls on this. So there's sort of a whole lot of applications of mixing. It's a very important problem, and there's been a lot of attempts to study it, ranging all the way from mixing in the interiors of stars, mechanical engineering, combustion engineering, atmospheric dispersion, tracers in oceanography, chemical engineering, chemical reactors, food engineering. That was the taffy pull, although, you know, basically, I don't know if you know this, but almost every food we eat is basically engineered now rather than cooked. And so there's a whole science, a lot of money that goes into figuring out how to blend additives into food in a way that you won't notice that they're there. And then bioengineering, bioreactors, physiology, you know, kind of the mixing that goes on in blood vessels is very important, and polymers, down to polymers. So what this is a plot of is a range, just this is kind of a sketch of a range of length scales in meters and the Reynolds number. Are you all familiar with the Reynolds number, all the students? There's some heads shaking. Okay, we'll see. Okay. So so basically what we're looking at is the Reynolds number is essentially a non-dimensional number that's going to tell you whether a flow is going to be turbulent or laminar. And one of the things I noticed about this plot is that, you know, most applications that people study fall in this kind of trend here, but geophysics falls off to itself. And by geophysics, I mean mantle convection. So where would the core fall on this? Somewhere else. somewhere else. Magma oceans would fall somewhere else, presumably, than there. But for mantle convection, it falls in the low long-length scale and low Reynolds number area. So let's just mention for a minute what a Reynolds number is so that you have an idea. And then I'm going to show you a film clip going way back to the classics. Okay, so the Reynolds number is essentially a measure of, I'm not going to dwell on this, but the Reynolds number is essentially going to tell you whether things are turbulent or not. Let's see what notation I want. So it's a non-dimensional number, and it's essentially the velocity of a system, the length scale, and the kinematic viscosity. Okay, so the way the Reynolds number was sort of, one of the classic applications of it is in flow in a pipe. If you have flow in a pipe, coming through a pipe, you may want to know if you're an engineer whether that flow is turbulent or laminar. And so the Reynolds number is going to give you a balance of the forces that are driving the flow and the force and the viscous forces that are tending to damp out turbulence together. And so those are going to balance in some way. So this is analogous a little bit to the Rayleigh number, which is a little more complicated. The velocity here would be the average velocity in this pipe. And the length scale would not be the length of the pipe, but the radius of the pipe or the diameter of the pipe. And the viscosity is going to be the viscosity of the fluid. And empirically, we can find that that when that Reynolds number exceeds roughly 2,500, this flow is going to make a transition from simple laminar flow to turbulent flow. The place that happens, the transition, the critical Reynolds number, really varies depending on the particular application. But in this kind of application, at about a Reynolds number of about 2,500-ish, we'll have a transition, so we'll say greater than that. We'll have turbulent flow, and less than that, we're going to have laminar. Okay, and so this is a useful kind of shorthand. What this allows us to do is basically take this kind of dimensionless number in general, and I don't want to get into scale analysis, dimensional analysis here, because we don't really have time. But what this sort of number allows us to do is basically explain flows in terms of their scale. So a small pipe with a Reynolds number greater than 2,500 is going to be turbulent, and a large pipe with a Reynolds number greater than 2,500 is going to be turbulent. Less than 2,500, it's going to be. So you can put it like oil or something or a viscous material, a very viscous material with a high viscosity into a very large pipe and have a large velocity, and you might get turbulent flow. You can put water, which, you know, relatively low viscosity, into a little tiny pipe and have a low velocity, and you'll have laminar flow.
Would you be able, by looking at your movie,
yeah,
to immediately identify whether it was laminar or turbulent? It looked turbulent,
yeah,
to me.
Right. So I'm sort of, no, because this kind of question. When we're dealing with convection, the Reynolds number is not the only thing at play here, because we also have buoyancy forces and temperature happening, and those give us a Rayleigh number, which is what drives convection. So you'll hear people talk about turbulence, hard turbulence in the mantle, and that they mean is very, very high level, high Rayleigh number, which means very time-dependent flow and, you know, really active eddies and so on developing. But they're not really talking about turbulence in the sense of this sort of turbulence. So the turbulence, basically, I think there's actually a poem that describes this very well, which I like. Big whirls make little whirls that feed on their velocity. Little whirls make smaller whirls, and so on to viscosity. Has anybody ever heard that? Whirls, in case you don't, whirls like that. Okay, so big whirls make little whirls that feed on their velocity. Little whirls make smaller whirls, and so on to viscosity. So basically, in a turbulent flow, you're going to have lots of eddies that are going to be scale invariant. They're going to be large eddies and small eddies, essentially the big ones are going to feed on the small ones and so are going to spawn off small eddies, and so on, down to the point where the viscous forces damp out the velocity variations and smooth them out. So this viscosity acts like a diffusivity for momentum, and it smooths it out. And that's in the mantle, that's certainly happening at the smallest scale. You're not getting lots and lots of whirls. Okay. So that's by Richardson, that little poem.
Louise, yeah. Last night at dinner we had a discussion of eddies, and I realized I don't actually know what the definition of an eddy is.
Oh, geez. The definition of an eddy?
Yeah.
The definition of an eddy.
Yeah.
There's a professor at Arizona State who's called Eddie.
I'm not sure I've ever really thought about the definition. I mean, I think I'm sure it is defined. Yeah. It's a whirl.
Yeah.
Right. It's basically a.
No, you can't define
it. It has to do with
other words.
Well, how about this flow that's dominated by
vorticity?
Momentum?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's probably a good way to put it.
Does it have to have a stagnant point to be an eddy?
It's
translated, but.
Yeah.
But at some point, the angular
momentum. Instantaneously,
but,
yes,
but
it would.
You always would have like a fly of a tornado kind of thing. But it can translate as a unit.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Instantaneously, it would.
But at some point, you have to have zero angular momentum.
That's right, yeah.
So that's a good definition.
Yeah, I guess so.
Usually, you think of it as a roughly circular area where the vorticity is roughly constant.
Roughly constant, right.
And the way in which you form an eddy is through a momentum boundary layer detaching from a surface, and within a boundary layer, velocity varies roughly linearly. And so the vorticity, which is the curl of the velocity, is roughly constant.
There you go. Okay. There's a good definition. I never think about these flows. I only ever think about low Reynolds number flows. So, however, I want to show you something. So, okay, let's see if I can pull this off. This is this is going to be a multimedia extravaganza here. So, check out this font. In the 1960s, the early 1960s, NSF funded a series of fluid mechanics films. And they were basically educational, and they were designed to illustrate some of the basic processes. And so I'm putting this out here mostly because it's a resource that you might want to tap into at some point. So if you Google fluid mechanics film series, you'll probably get some of these things. They have been, you can see the resolution isn't so good. When they were films, they were very high quality, and they've been sort of scanned and digitized and so on. But I want to just bring up this is the one about low, oh, thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Let's see if I can do this. Uh-oh. I have to have it play for a minute. I wasn't able to download it. It's on a server somewhere. 17. What did I say I wanted to do? Okay. So I will not... 1309. Okay. I just made a note to myself about which part I wanted to show you. This one is actually narrated by G.I. Taylor, who's a... brilliant, fluid dynamics guy, and I will not. Oh, it's so bad. It's a digitized thing. Okay, there he is. There's Mr. Taylor. Sorry?
Sorry. I didn't even get a PhD.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
Too old.
This was him in 19.
His late 80s.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna attempt to show this. It won't allow you. I'm sorry about this sort of business here. Okay, what I really want is. That was where I wanted to show you. Okay. This is a series about low Reynolds number flow. The nice thing about these film series. The nice thing about this film series is that they have a series of experiments and flow visualizations that are all right. That's not where I wanted to be. There we go. Okay. That would be difficult to set up, you know, in an individual lab. And so they do this series of, okay, we'll have to watch him talk for a couple of minutes. Sorry, I'll just explain what I'm going to show you. So they did a series of experiments, and they have narrators that are really some of the great minds in fluid dynamics of that time, and some of the great minds ever, actually, in fluid dynamics. And they're explaining these things. So they're not slick modern, you know, they're kind of, they might be a little hard for the modern... What is going on here? I don't know what's happening with this. There we go. Okay. So what he's going to do, what he's talking about here is the reversibility of mixing in a flow that is low Reynolds number. And so what he's done is he's made this journal bearing thing where he basically has a vat of syrup, and you can see what the experiment looks like. It's got a kind of cylinder in the center and a cylinder around the outside, and he's stirring the cylinder around the outside, and he's put that little red dye in there, and he's turning it slowly enough that the Reynolds number, the velocity is low, and the Reynolds number remains low. And it looks as though this stuff has mixed, but now he's turning it the other direction, and we'll see what happens. We'll see whether this mixing was reversible or not.
To be continued.
Oh no, don't do this to me. Oh, come on, the big drama moment. It's going to be lost here. What do you think is going to happen? Why would I be showing it to you otherwise?
Have you ever tried?
Have I ever tried this? No, I have never tried this.
Yeah,
it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? So why doesn't it work?
It works very well because I'm not GI Taylor as well.
So can you make this work, Michael?
Of course.
There we go. Oh, why is it? I don't know why. I had this running happily on my computer mere minutes before. It's running in RealPlayer. I can't download it. It lets you run it on the network. So now we're looking at this thing from above, and you can see he's made a little box there, of a little square, and basically he's stretching it. And you would expect that this stretching, you might expect that diffusion would come into play. Okay, let's see. Maybe this will work.
No way.
Oh no, it's like right before the denouement. Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. I literally had this running. I checked this minutes before we started this. Is everybody downloading stuff all at once now for the tutorial? I might be on the wireless. Maybe I should plug it in. Let's see what happens. Now it has to figure out. All right. I'm sorry about that. I'll email you the location of this and you can look at it yourself. Anyway, there's some interesting stuff in these. So basically, what happens is the sphere, the symbol or whatever it is that he drew in there, gets distorted, and then it gets undistorted. So this is the point of this is that this is a reversible process. You sort of saw that a little bit almost start to happen in the little blob at the beginning that moved around and then unstretched a little bit, although that was not reversing the flow, so it didn't perfectly unstretch. So I'm going to give up on the multimedia extravaganza here. Sorry about that. All right.
How much does time play a role in that? Like, if they would have mixed for much longer, would it still be reversible?
If you stretch that stuff out, and actually, if you look at this you can see that little sphere in particular has soft edges when it comes back into play. So there is some molecular diffusion that goes on when it's all stretched out. So it doesn't come back to a perfect blob. It comes back to a sort of fuzzy, slightly fuzzy blob. So the longer if they let it sit for a while, that would be more of a problem, right?
I guess after seeing this, low Reynolds numbers are reversible, but now that first slide you showed with Otino's with the periodic boundary condition,
yeah.
Is that low Reynolds number?
That is low Reynolds number, but it's a chaotic boundary condition. So he would have a hard time reversing the velocities. So in order to, this sort of simple experiment with just a a tank with a cylinder in it, and he's turning it, and then he's unturning it. He's basically reproducing the same velocities going in both directions. But
in Otino, you see those periodic, so it seems like it's just reversing. Or is that
if it were purely, yes, it's periodic. There's actually two periodic.
He's got two components
to it, and they are not in phase, and so that's what allows that to happen. Yes, thank you for asking that, actually. It's a good point. So the velocities have to be reversible, and of course they're not going to be in the mantle, and so that's what's going to give you that. So, okay, so in theory, we could basically unstretch this and reproduce that, but we might get a little bit of diffusion. So, all right, well, that didn't work so well. So, sorry about the multimedia thing. I'll send you the link. I'll put the link up on BSpace, and then everybody can download it all at once, and you can run into the same problem. There are a whole lot of these films, and they are, like I said, they're a little bit hard for a modern audience to watch, but they are very useful, and there are some on boundary layers, there's some on turbulence, there's a variety of things. Some of them would not be of so much interest to us, but some of them are of a lot of interest to this group, probably, presumably. Okay, so let's ask ourselves whether chemical diffusion, on what scale this happens in the mantle, and again, I'm referring back to an ancient paper of my own, actually, in which we tried to address this question after the marble cake mantle paper came out. And so what we did is we looked, I'm not going to show you the math, but I can provide you the paper. It's very straightforward, actually. We put in a band into a very simple flow field, which is a simple stretching and thinning flow field, pure shear, if you like that kind of notation, exponential thinning. We basically are pulling it in this direction horizontally, and it's being pushed by the sort of return flow in the vertical direction. So that band is going to get thinner and thinner and thinner. And it's slightly shaded. It's going to have a different, essentially, composition in some fashion, some arbitrary way, dye, a different dye, than the surrounding material. And we allow some diffusion to take place. And then we wrote down, it turns out you can write down an analytical expression for the concentration of dye, assuming some diffusivity, some rate of diffusivity. And then you can essentially you can calculate what the concentration of dye is in a cross section across this, and that's what's plotted up here. So we had to assume a rate of strain for the mantle, and we did that in the simplest possible way by imagining a plate going over the mantle and shearing it. And so basically you have a plate motion of, you know, 1 to 10 centimeters per year, distributed over a depth of the mantle, which could be the upper mantle or the whole mantle or any part of the mantle you want. And when you do that, you'll get a strain rate of roughly 10 to the minus 15th per second. You'll often see people use that. This is a back of the envelope kind of calculation that gives you a kind of characteristic or typical or kind of canonical strain rate for the mantle. And so it's useful. It can vary by some orders of magnitude depending on what the flow field is like. But what you see here is essentially what happens. Okay, so now we started out with a 6-kilometer crust because that was the idea behind the marble cake mantle. We stuck it into this flow and then we look at what happens to it. And we have some timeline here where after it takes about 350 to 500 million years before anything starts to happen. So after 350 million years, this thing at this strain rate has been stretched and thinned to the point where it's only 10 centimeters across or a little bit more. And it still has, that's the concentration of that dye, it still has a core that has the maximum concentration, the same concentration of dye that it started out with. So after 350 million years of this thing of exponentially fast stretching and thinning, this thing is still distinctive in the mantle. And that's really the point. Down to the few centimeter scale, molecular diffusion is not going to be effective at homogenizing the mantle. And then it rapidly disappears after that. And so just another way of looking at that sort of thing is here's this is just different strain rates and the sort of the thickness at which this thing starts to disappear, become measurably, noticeably smaller, and it's in the range of a few centimeters. So basically, that sort of homogenization by molecular diffusion isn't going to happen in the mantle until you get down to the scale of a few centimeters. And when you're getting down to the scale of a few centimeters, it's really not fair to treat mantle materials as a continuum with a dye in it anymore, because you're really talking about you know, individual grains of minerals, and you're talking about different processes at that point. So we really have to think about it in a different way when we get to that scale at the mantle. Just one more point about this. We have here sort of a timeline for homogenization varying the strain rate here, and there are three curves on here, and the main point of this is that there are three curves with three different molecular diffusivities ranging over three orders of magnitude, and yet the curves basically fall on top of each other. The point of that is that the molecular diffusivity doesn't really make any difference here. We can have a lot of uncertainty in it, but it doesn't change the net result, which is that mixing in the mantle occurs primarily by stretching and thinning and folding and all those mechanical processes, and not really by molecular diffusion. Okay? So that's kind of the main point of this. All right, so going back to that marble cake mantle, because it's kind of fun, they also looked at, they also did some back of the envelope calculations to figure out the time scales as a way of figuring out the scale of heterogeneity. And this kind of plot crops up from time to time, so it may be worth going through it a little bit.
So the diffusivities in the paper that you just, on the previous slide, where did those come from?
They seem slow. Yeah, they were.
They're normal.
For composition, for basically diffusivity of say, I don't know, lead isotopes in the system, they might be higher for helium. That would be a question to ask. Are they higher enough?
6 for helium.
10 to the minus 6.
Centimeters per cent.
Yeah. Yeah, so 10 to the minus 6 for helium. So that could fall off that line.
That's 10 orders of magnitude faster.
Right.
So molecular diffusion for helium is important.
Could be important. That's right. So that's going to bring that up a little bit. Yeah. And this isn't for heat. This isn't mixing. This is not homogenizing temperature variations, just chemical variations. So that's a question. Okay, do I really want to go through this? Let me see. All right, so this sort of thing crops up from time to time, so I'm going to mention it just briefly. I'm just going to kind of go through this little thing. And I wrote down notes so that I would use the same notation they do in case you ever want to look up the paper. So essentially, Stan asked me about overturn times. And essentially, what they're trying to do here is figure out what the time scale is for processing stuff through the mid-ocean ridges. So this was the other half of this paper. One half was this idea of a marble cake mantle coming from looking at the peroxide bands in the pyritite. And the other half was figuring out how you would generate those in the mantle and whether you could generate them on time scales relevant to the Earth. Okay? And so they did this in sort of a very simple way. They don't draw this picture, but they basically imagine the Earth or the mantle, rather, as having an influx of mass. So we have a mass of the mantle. Make sure I use their same. Yes. Okay. And we have essentially some process that is bringing material into the mantle at some rate. And that process is presumably, they intended this to represent subduction of a layered slab. So a lithosphere and a thin veneer of crust on top of it. And so during an interval of time, tau, this is the amount of mantle that gets recycled into this is the amount of lithosphere that gets recycled into the mantle. And if you do that, if you look at that, and then it gets recycled again or gets kind of cycled back out again, presumably somewhere else at a mid-ocean ridge. And if you look at that, you can basically write an equation that just a very simple equation that just explains kind of I use tau. Okay, I hate that part of this, the tau part. You can basically write an equation that relates the rate of influx of this material to the to the rate of change of, to basically the rate of material that's being processed through the mantle, okay? And so this is a sort of processing time. So this is an influx time, and this is a time derivative of the mantle as well. And this is the mass of the mantle. Okay, so this is essentially the influx into the mantle, and this is the characteristic overturn time. So from that, we can basically get a characteristic processing time. I'll just solve that. Okay, and we can get a characteristic processing time for the mantle. Oops, tau. That's why I have the notes. Okay, and we can get an equation for tau. And tau is going to be essentially the mass of the mantle over the processing time, or over the influx into the mantle. And so that's an interesting time scale. It's basically a characteristic time scale for processing the mantle. Now, this kind of time where you have the mass of a reservoir and the mass of the pipe coming in and out of the sort of rate of mass coming in and out of the reservoir is something that comes up in geochemistry as well as a residence time or as a processing time. So I know some people don't like the word reservoir, but if we treat the mantle as, or a part of the mantle as a box, and then we have a pipe of material that's coming in and a pipe of material that's coming out, and if it's steady state, we can calculate the average, essentially the time that a typical molecule of material or little particle of material will spend in that box. And in effect, that's what this is doing. We can do this with a variety of other kinds of, in a variety of other kinds of ways. For example, if this were the population of the Earth, this is an analogy I've heard, this were a population of the Earth and the population of the Earth were steady state, and this were the rate of births and deaths to keep that steady state, this would be the lifespan of a typical person. Okay, so that's one way to think about a reservoir, a residence time in a reservoir, is by thinking about this. Sort of how long, if you pump if you pipe some material into a box and then you pull material out of the box, how long does your average molecule of material stay in that box? That doesn't mean that everything is going to stay in the box for that amount of time, but it means the sort of averages. And then what they did is essentially asked sort of how much material then is older than that time. And the material that's older than that time has not been processed through this cycling process. And so this is a very kind of simple plot, but it's sort of useful. They had to basically relate this to our knowledge of how much plate is being preserved, how much plate area is being produced and destroyed by subduction. And they picked a thickness of the lithosphere of like 60 kilometers or something like that, and then they came up with these curves. I don't remember which one's which. Okay, so the one on the left is for the entire mantle, and the one on the right is for layered mantle convection. So in the plot on the right, only the upper mantle is being above 660 is being processed through this process, and on the curves on the left, the entire mantle is being processed through. And in this sort of steady state situation, what you get is this is the mass of the mantle that's older than this time. The proportion of the mantle that's older than this age, and that's billions of years, so 1 to 4 billion years. So even after 4 billion years, half of the mantle in this case only half of the mantle has been processed through the mantle. Basically, this is an exponential, and the time constant is 4.5 billion years for some reason, works out that way. So half of the mantle has been processed through. In this plot, that's the dashed line. In this plot, for the upper mantle, most of the mantle has been processed through the mid-ocean ridges. So this is going to give you some idea of the kind of processing time. And when we want to talk about things like outgassing of the mantle, these are kind of useful numbers to keep in your head, right?
Would that be most of the upper mantle?
This would be most of, yes, I'm sorry, yes, it would be most of the upper mantle. Is that, so thank you for asking. The solid line, let me get to the solid line in a minute. Let me just say that when they talk about this, they sort of they wrote this at a time when there were these two end members, only these two end members, whole mantle convection and layered mantle convection. And so they, if you go back and read this paper, they talk about the mantle being processed through. They mean upper mantle. So you need to, you just have to read it carefully when you talk about that. In the solid lines, they assume that the rate of spreading centers, the production of plate, has slowed down over time due to radioactive decay of the heat production sources that are driving the system. And so they introduced a time decay constant that that basically allows that has a faster rate of spreading, a faster rate of this process through in the past, and then that gives them a different time scale. So this may be more realistic. They argued that this was more realistic, and this has essentially, you know, only a quarter of the mantle or something not being processed through the mid-ocean ridges by now, and it has all of the upper mantle being processed through the mid-ocean ridges by now. And so you can play around with these things. You can introduce different time scales. You can, you know, you can discuss how much would spreading rates have sped up or slowed down over time. Is it realistic to use whatever time constant they used for that or not? And then you can also talk about whether this has any direct relationship to what's happening in the mantle. In other words, should we think about these sorts of regions as being related to a particular region in the mantle or what? But they did this in this sort of simple way. They're not the only ones to do this, and I don't want to pretend that they're the only ones who have done this kind of thing. But it's sort of a useful thing to think about. Okay. So there's a lot of background. Now what I'm going to do with the rest of the time is talk about some different ways that people have looked at mixing in a more dynamical sense. So we've really been talking about the kind of kinematics of the mixing, and we haven't really put it into a dynamical calculation at all. When we do that, we're going to find a lot of complexities. And so, okay, yes. I'm not going to try and be comprehensive about this. I'm going to try and basically give you a sampling of methods and talk about the sampling, the sort of different types of methods that people use. There's been a lot of work published on this, that's why I can't be completely comprehensive about this. But generally speaking, there's sort of two ways that people study this kind of problem. One is by looking at, by putting in particles of the sort that I showed you in that animation, and looking at what happens to them. And when I say looking, you can either look visually or you can do some kind of statistical analysis. You can calculate deformation of those particles. You know, you can do a variety of things. And the other thing that people do, and actually Peter's done a lot of this work, and some other folks have as well, or done some of this work, is basically tying those particle distributions or heterogeneity distributions to a specific isotopic system and deriving from that a distribution of isotopes that you would then try and relate back to the geochemical observations that I showed in the sort of second slide. So those are sort of two of the ways that people look at this sort of thing. Okay, here's another classic. This is Peter Olson, Dave Ewan, Derek Balsinger did some very early calculations of dispersal of heterogeneities in a convecting system. I'm showing this because it's the same era as the Hoffman and McKenzie thing that you showed. And so this was essentially state of the art in 1984. There was very low computing power available by comparison to now. They put in they have a very simple sort of overturning flow, and they put in a blob of heterogeneities there, and this is the source, this little rectangle, and then they allowed it to stir, and they're observing it in this region here that they call sample. And so that's blown up here. And so what you're seeing is this stuff comes around, it's stretched, it's thinned, and it's stretched out when it passes by the first time, then we have another snapshot later, it's passing by a second time. What we're developing is a series of laminations, they call them, that are distributed through the upper mantle. And you know, one of the things that I think is a productive area for the future is to try and relate the sort of structures that we see, the complex and sometimes simple structures that we see, to anisotropy in the mantle and see if we can figure out whether it tells us any, whether seismic anisotropy is related in any way to the kinds of structures we see in these dynamical models. I don't know the answer to that. Okay, so this is one of, again, a plot from the same paper, and I'm sorry it's not so good after obviously having been scanned to make a PDF out of it. But what you are seeing here is that's the model. Now they've put tracers in half the model, and they have sort of bimodal distribution of tracers. Lots of black tracers on one side, lots of white tracers on the other side, and they have a histogram here at the top of the distribution of tracers. So it's a bimodal distribution. And then what we're looking at is through time, we're looking at some sampling. And so this is the starting point, later time, later time, later time. Starting point, later time, later time, later time. The difference between these two figures on the left and on the right is the box that they used to sample to create the histogram. So what they did is they took this region, put a series of boxes in it, and then counted the number of tracers and then plotted up as a histogram. That's a kind of simple statistical way of looking at this thing, and they can fit, you know, a curve to this, and they can look at how bimodal or unimodal it is.
The box size
here is a quarter of the size of the box, and here it's 1/64th of the size of the entire box. Right. So what you see is when the calculation is the same. What you see when you have a large box sampling size is that the distribution of the heterogeneities appears to be homogeneous at the end of this run. What you see when you have small box sampling size is that the distribution of heterogeneities towards the end here appears to be Gaussian or something. Yes?
Would it be worth pointing out whether this simulation is time dependent or not? I assume it's constant velocity field, whereas the movie you showed obviously had a time dependent.
Yeah, but this principle is the same. Yeah, that's right. I think this is steady or close to steady. Mm-hmm. The principle is the same, and I actually quote it from this paper. Underresolved sampling leads to apparent homogeneity. So the scale at which we can sample the mantle is critically important to our understanding of what the homogeneity is. And when we talk about mixing or when we talk about heterogeneity, we need to know what we're talking about. If we're talking about a large box, then the mantle may appear to be homogeneous, but if we can sample the mantle at a very small scale, the mantle may appear to be homogeneous, and that's simply a matter of this sampling question. And that's a general statement that can apply to practically any of these things. Okay, I'm not going to bother with that. All right, so I'm going to show you this to show you a slightly kind of a one of the factors that appears, and this is. Peter Van Kecken and Chris Valentin did a series of papers on the effect of increasing the viscosity at the lower mantle. So the rest of the talk, I'm going to basically talk about a handful of different things that affect the rate of mixing. And one of them is possibly viscosity increase in the lower mantle. We know that the viscosity of the lower mantle is higher than the upper mantle. And so Chris and Peter did some work on this, and I don't have the color slides from your figure, so I'm showing the color slides from our later work. So we did some work related to that later, a couple years later, in which we basically added particles and pulled them out, and then tried to look at whether we could slow down mixing in some way by increasing the viscosity in the lower mantle. And so I'm going to show you three different calculations, and one of them is the sort of reference calculation is the one that movie was from, where we had internal heating, just basic vanilla convection. Then we also increased the viscosity with depth in an exponential way, and then we also had this big jump with viscosity at depth to see if we could prevent mixing from happening in the lower mantle. And I guess I should say that the movie was designed as an illustration. You wouldn't use, I mean, I put those particles in an arbitrary place, so I wouldn't really want to use those to try and do a statistical analysis of any sort of the mantle. Instead, we have to be a little bit more thoughtful about where we place the tracers and how that relates to any sort of geologic process. So in this particular case, what we did is we added particles at the downwellings, basically going back to that marble cake mantle idea. We added particles at the downwellings, wherever they were. We pulled them out at the upwellings. anywhere where the flow diverged, we pulled them out. And the idea there was to try and represent something like a something like a process of melting under a mid-ocean ridge without actually doing anything, any really physics of melting, but resetting a clock at a mid-ocean ridge, an isotopic clock at a mid-ocean ridge, and then subducting material that may or may not have some crustal component to it into the mantle. And what happens is, over time, this gradually builds up a number of particles that have a distribution of age. This is like our influx and outflow that has, it has a statistical steady state. It varies a little bit, but this is sort of statistical steady state that develops. And that looks a little bit like this. And what you're seeing at the top should look a lot like that animation I showed. The particles are more uniformly distributed because we're adding them all over the place. And the thing that, I want you to look at down here, though, is this this situation where we had a big jump in viscosity at 660, and then contrast that with the situation where we have a smooth increase in viscosity with depth. So we were basing this kind of model on the idea that perhaps it had been suggested that perhaps sluggish convection in the lower mantle is really good at preserving heterogeneities, because things are slower in the lower mantle, and so that should, things should mix more slowly. Higher viscosity, things should mix more slowly. So we wanted to look at whether that led us to a, an uneven distribution, a vertical distribution of heterogeneities. And what's the answer, Peter? Doesn't, right? You're shaking your head. So it doesn't. And the, this has been found by a variety of different approaches, people using different geometries, using different models, but we all basically come up with the same conclusion, which is that you can't really stratify the mantle just by a viscosity stratification. What happens instead is you get, here's a, what happens here is that instead of having that very lively dynamic flow that you saw in the movie, we get, a, in this case, a very simple upwelling here, downwellings here, and we get lots of, you know, we get kind of two cells that develop. And those two cells don't mix laterally, but they mix very well internally. When we have this transition zone jump, the viscosity jump, we get a very kind of bizarre little structure with these two sort of eyes that are isolated forever from the surrounding mantle, and then these two other eyes that are also somewhat isolated, although they're not quite as clear. This very much resembles that Otino kind of model from the very beginning, but it's not kinematically driven. This is a dynamical calculation solving the convection equations. Yeah?
So what's the rule by which you decide how many particles to add? Do the mid-ocean ridges?
Yeah.
Is there a conservation of particles, or is there a constant rate of particles?
There's a constant rate of particle addition. I can't remember what it was in this particular case, but if, you know, dozens or hundreds every time. There's a constant rate of particle addition, and so, well, based on the sort of, it's proportional to the velocity at the downwelling or the up, at the downwelling, and there's a constant rate of removal. Basically, everything that came within 100 kilometers of an upwelling got removed. So it's not constant, it's statistically the same over time. So it's really depends on the dynamics. And there's a little bit of fluctuation in the number of particles that we find. But what happens is that, you know, we add a bunch of particles, then it sort of evens out, and then it it becomes pretty much a steady state kind of situation. Okay. So what we did to try and do something a little bit less than just a picture, although this is still a picture, is looked at basically color-coded. We binned these things into boxes. Again, remember the cautionary statement from the Olson et al. Thing, the paper, that the size of the box is going to determine whether the mantle appears homogeneous or heterogeneous. But we binned these things into pretty small boxes, and then we color-coded the boxes by basically where the average location, starting location of the particles in those boxes was. Okay, so what that means is that if particles were introduced here, they were going to tend to make the box that they land in red. If they started in here, if there was a downwelling here, there is actually a downwelling here right now, so that box is completely yellow. And then those yellow particles are going to move around. And so we binned everything and then basically said, where did those particles originate? And we color-coded the box by where the particles in that box originated. So we're sort of homogenizing the box and then color-coding it. And what you can see is what you saw visually as well, is that this was that generic, that vanilla convection model with the many tracers. You can see that, you know, things are not perfectly mixed. They're fairly well mixed within this kind of region, but not perfectly. And then they're fairly well mixed over here, but not perfectly. But this is definitely bluer than that is. And this is definitely more yellow than that is. And so that suggests that this yellow stuff has been moving, drifting to the left here. And this blue stuff, this is actually a wraparound boundary condition. So it can drift out the back and then back in here. Or it could go the other way. So it basically is moving around. And so what we're seeing here is the same thing I said earlier, which is we have a local scale mixing, but global scale heterogeneity. But we don't have vertical stratification. And that simply becomes this local scale mixing and global scale heterogeneity becomes more pronounced as we move into these as we move into the situation where there's a big jump in viscosity in the lower mantle. There's no vertical stratification here apparent, but there is lots of lateral heterogeneity, basically because this stabilizes the flow into two cells. Yeah.
How much of the red color that's in the top plot is just from, after this has run for some period of time, is just from the particles moving back to where they originally started, even though they've been transported?
They don't change color.
Okay, gotcha.
Those are the initial. They are color-coded according to where they started. Yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Mark.
In the top, when you run into a steady state and do it lots of times, and you look at the compositional spectrum, are they always about the same?
Yeah, they are basically always about the same. We run it to a steady-ish state. It's time-dependent models, but we run these to a kind of statistical steady state, and then we start introducing the particles. So we don't introduce particles until after we've gone through the initial thermal evolution of the model, because we don't want to mess that up. Yeah. Someone else? Did I see another hand? No.
What does the color mean? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, those?
Oh, those are the colors of the. So when a particle dropped in this region, it gets color coded red. When a particle starts in this just the sort of horizontal range.
The next question would be, why the yellow one prevail, not the red or other prevail?
Right. That's easiest to see in this situation where we basically had the flow stabilizing itself into two downwellings and one upwelling. And that kind of happens. There's a dominant wavelength, basically. And so we sort of have downwellings more often here and here and less often in other places. It's basically just the wavelength of the flow. So we might have been able to do something else to kind of, you know, not be so heavily dominated by the yellow and blue. But in this case in particular, there's really one downwelling in the center of each of these cells. And in this case, there's just not very many downwelling.
You say that there's no vertical stratification, I think, but it looks like that these voids where there are no particle presence tend to be concentrated right below the 660.
Mm-hmm. The voids are definitely there, yes. Yes, you're right about that. Yeah, and so those voids are a little perplexing, I got to say. They, I kind of imagined that they occurred in, they appear all the time in Otino's work in these kinematic mixing, you know, things. And I sort of had in mind that they were due to resonances, and that's kind of how he explains them, resonances in the motion of the driving of the plates that are driving the stirring. So he's basically taking a big tank and then stirring it either with some kind of egg beater kind of thing internally or some sort of boundary condition of one sort or another. And so, you know, you might think that would basically be just resonances giving rise to sort of resonant areas that are kind of isolated. But this is not that kind of calculation. This is we're solving the Boussinesq equations for thermal convection, and yet these things appear. And so, So
this would be the kind of primitive man.
Sure. I'm hesitant to say that, because when I say this is the primitive mantle, geochemists leap up and say, there is no primitive mantle, right? There is no primitive mantle.
But that's also not the Earth. I mean,
no, it's also not the Earth. That's right. Yeah. It would certainly be mantle that is isolated from everything else for a long time. The funny thing is it doesn't show up as thermally different because it's small enough that the heat just goes right through and goes out, in and out, so it's no big deal.
Are they like strange attractors in a chaotic?
They are a little bit like strange attractors. So I actually think this would benefit from a chaotic system, from a dynamical systems approach to this problem. Yeah. The equations don't lend themselves to that kind of approach, and so it really hasn't been done, that kind of approach.
So each pixel here basically tells you the dominant, or, you know, the most yellow particles are, or yellow particles are the most abundant particle within each pixel.
It tells you that that box right there mm-hmm. has more red particles than anything else.
Okay, mm-hmm. so that's why no red or anything down at the in the transition zone one.
Yeah, nothing came in over here. It all came in. It all came in between there and there.
So the red is very homogenized, but the yellow is not so homogenized.
Well, there basically were, in this case, I think there were really not very many particles coming in at this in this corner. The downwellings really never made it over to that side.
So it's counterclockwise in the lower
box. Yeah, that's right. It's like that. Well, it's like that and like that. So there's an upwelling there, not so much of a downwelling.
Has anybody looked at the size of these regions, these black regions, and what that relates to?
Well, what do you mean? I mean, I know what the size they are.
How small they are, how big they are, whether that relates to, I don't know, the jump in the viscosity or something else.
Yeah, that could benefit from a systematic analysis of this, I will say.
Because you could, you know, then see whether they are at all significant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, two questions behind you, and then I guess actually we'll say something about that using one of John Nalaboff's models.
Just a comment on what Barbara was saying is, in your lower case, the viscosity is on the biggest portion of the system is much higher, right?
Much higher.
You have maybe less time dependence, and your stagnation point could be more or less fixed in time.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's more or less what you're looking at.
That's
have
more
you
or less
tried to look at a spectrum of distribution of this?
Spectrum, on this particular one, no, we weren't doing that then.
There might be some structure, for example. On the
yeah, that's right.
Point in size.
Yeah, so, okay, now I'll make another point about that in a minute.
So these are completely passive, they have no...
The tracers are passive.
Yeah, they have no, and there's, have you tried doing this with, like, putting in an eclogitized crust and seeing how where it goes?
I have not. So there are people who have done that, and so the biggest contribution I've made to that was, again, like a simple straight stagnation point flow, looking at the effect of viscosity on deformation of an ellipse in that situation. And we haven't really taken that into this yet, which would be a natural thing to do. Michael Manga has done calculations with viscous blobs using a boundary element method, right? We're basically using where he introduces blobs, and if I have time, I'll show you one picture from one of his papers about that, that have a different viscosity. They're finite-sized blobs that have a different, they're sort of large, actually, that have a different viscosity from the surrounding mantle, and you can see how they deform. So there's some work being done on that.
Is it realistic to think that these stagnation points are going to be long-lived or staying there for a long time? Because of the real Earth, the trenches are migrating all the time.
Yeah, I know. My answer to that used to be a definitive no. I think that once you know you have migrating things, they're going to disappear. I've become slightly less sure of that over time, actually. John, who's back there, for his master's degree, did a similar calculation. The reason I'm going to show you this is that it basically moves through. So we had sort of an extreme. We had isoviscous and then extremely high viscosity contrast, and so we get these sort of weird islands. And so, but there's something else that happens in this. In this case, he was inspired by the work of Badreau et al. That looks at a change in the spin state of iron in the lower mantle. And they hypothesized that change in the spin state of iron might increase the thermal diffusivity by a huge amount and might increase the viscosity by a huge amount. And so we said, okay, let's try turning that knob in these simulations and see what happens. And so what you're looking at here, we've moved to temperature-dependent viscosity and pressure-dependent viscosity and all sorts of things. So this is a little bit more of an advanced model. And what you're looking at here is this is a function f, which is just a factor, a multiplicative factor for the viscosity and the thermal conductivity. Okay, so when F is high, when F is 1, we have basically uniform viscosity, although it's temperature dependent, and so we have a cold thermal boundary layer on the top that's strong, and then you know it gets weaker as we get into the interior. When F is 10, we multiply that viscosity by a factor of 10, and when we get into the lower mantle, we bump up the viscosity by a factor of 10, and we also bump up the conductivity by a factor of 10. And so the effect of that is to is to try and suppress, it's basically to reduce the effective Rayleigh number. So when Peter was talking about Rayleigh numbers, he said, watch out, you can really get into trouble with the Rayleigh number because it assumes that everything has constant properties. And this is exactly the kind of situation he was referring to, where we have variable properties with everything varying in every direction. But if you want to think about a Rayleigh number, what you should think about is that the two factors that we are increasing in the lower mantle, the viscosity and the conductivity, are both the kinds of things that would lower a Rayleigh number and therefore would tend to suppress convection in the lower mantle. I don't think anybody thinks that I should ask one of the mineral physicists here. I don't think anybody thinks that a spin state transition in the lower mantle is likely to increase the viscosity and the thermal conductivity by a factor of 150. That's a pretty big number. But what we decided to do is basically pass through no effect all the way through sort of what might be realistic out to extremely unrealistic to see whether we could get a nice sense of the physics of this process. And I'm going to show you three animations quickly, because that's the point I want to make here, is about kind of moving through a less important effect of this less viscosity increase to a greater viscosity increase. Here's our reference model. We've now basically color-coded particles, so there's a bunch of tracers in here. In this particular case, we've color-coded them, so there were four quadrants that kind of flashed on very quickly, and they're gradually mixing. And this is, by now, this should be very familiar-looking kind of pictures to you, with the blue and the red and the yellow and the green. So we're using the color in a different way here. We're just dumping the particles in there and color-coding them from the beginning.
What's the light within the quadrants when they just started?
That's basically, that's a good question. It's basically, there's some stretching that's going on that's separating the particles. There is conservation of mass here, but they're pulling away from that cold thermal boundary layer on the top, so somehow that's stretching a little bit. Okay. Now we've increased this factor F, so there's now basically at the midpoint in the mantle. Right, we just put this at the halfway point. We didn't bother with the upper mantle, lower mantle transition. We just put it right in the middle, so we wouldn't be introducing yet another length scale. And so that now there's basically this increase in the properties that would slow down flow in the lower half. And you can see what's happening. We're still getting these isolated regions. But you can also kind of see what's going on here. And then we stabilize the flow again, and we get sort of more of a bluish-greenish region over here and a more of a yellowish, reddish region on the left because we've stabilized the flow. One thing that you can see is happening is that a lot of stirring is happening in the upper mantle, and then those well-stirred packets, or these sort of rapidly moving packets, are moving wholesale into the lower mantle. And so that's part of what's going on that's preventing stratification in here. Essentially, all the action, the mixing action, is happening where the flow is moving very rapidly, but then it's just being carried into the quiet lower mantle where it just moves around, comes back up, and then stirring starts again. So that's why we don't get stratification, because of that. So now, next I'm going to bump this up by another factor. I think I go up to 100 in the next animation. And what do you think is going to happen? Are the eyes going to get bigger or smaller or more of them? Or anybody want to? I hate to do that, but they're going to increase. We might expect to see more dramatic isolation like this, but we don't. Instead, what we see is, again, now the flow in the lower layer is even more sluggish, but the eyes have gone away. Those isolated pockets have gone away. Well, there's some hint of them, but that's not going to last. That sort of gets stretched and thin. So we basically somehow moved in this sort of moving through, sort of marching up this one axis of parameter space. We have we've gone from sort of uniform mixing through a sort of region of phase space, if you want to call it that, where there are isolated pockets, and then right out the other side to a region where there are no isolated pockets. And so that's why I actually think this would benefit from a dynamical systems approach, because this is a little bit of and that's also why I don't know whether these things occur in the mantle, because clearly this sort of behavior is quite sensitive to the boundary conditions and to the equations of motion. So, and to the physical properties.
F was capital times V. viscosity?
It was. It's a factor that a multiplicative factor for kappa and for viscosity. Yeah, both. Both are increasing by a factor of 100.
Did you increase the Redding number? Yes.
I can't remember. Did we?
No, I don't think so. So the upper mantle, if you think about the Redding number, the upper mantle stays the same.
Yeah, roughly.
On the whole, you march down over, essentially, with F equals 100, you got four orders of magnitude lower.
Yeah.
The Nusselt number will then be
four orders of times. Yeah, the Nusselt number is going to be lower, but that's not really our goal here.
But eventually you must get to a point where the lower half just isn't convective because you don't below the critical range.
Yes, you've got to exactly.
So you must at some point come to a stage where you don't get anything going into the bottom.
I suppose that's true, but there's no mechanical barrier there. It's a coupled system, so there's nothing. You know, those buoyancy forces are still going to be acting there. Yes, if you make the lower mantle completely rigid, or you know, have it completely wipe out all temperature variations, then yes. But if you go back to the thermal model, what it looks like. This is basically what that looks like in terms of temperature. And you know, what it looks like if you were just looking at temperature is that this downwelling comes there and then spreads out. I mean, and in this case, it's even worse. If I were looking at this without looking at those streamlines, I might think that downwelling stops and doesn't go any farther. But the streamlines tell me that it's going through.
Are these internally heated again?
Yeah. Yes.
So I guess. There's no diffusion component when you're advecting the particles.
The only diffusion component is the whatever numerical error there is in our integration of the particles.
Because when you're then time stepping all of these advection time steps, is there some point where you just don't want to believe what the particles are doing anymore?
Yeah. Well, we've really paid a lot of attention to that, and you have to time step the particles very carefully. You have to use a very careful integration method to do that. And so, these are more expensive calculations to run numerically than just a basic convection model. One of the things to do is very simple, is we basically reduce the time step to a much smaller time step to increase the accuracy. And then we use a fourth order Runge-Kutta method to integrate the particle velocities in there, and then that's built into the finite element model.
Is it reversible?
This?
Can you wind all those communities backwards and get back to
theoretically, you could, yeah. I mean, that would be a measure of our error, essentially. Yeah. Yeah. We haven't done that. Yes?
Following Bajo's study, there were a couple of studies showing the thermal conductivity actually decreases. So
yes.
I wonder if that's the case, would it slow down convection in the mantle? Is that the
If it decreased?
Factor? Right.
No, it would speed it up.
If it decreases, that means heat will be blocked from the core, right? So
that's true.
Convection is very slow, so
yeah.
It may have smaller temperature contrast. I don't know.
But you'll have a larger temperature contrast locally, which will increase the buoyancy forces.
So we actually looked at that a little bit, and we decreased the thermal conductivity by some reasonable amounts, maybe like by 25% or 30%, so you should be a max. It has a small effect, but it really doesn't have that much of an effect. You know, a little bit on the basal heat damage, but in terms of the mix, it really doesn't affect it that much.
So what is the critical parameter effect mixing? Is it viscosity?
I guess it would be viscosity and compositional more in compositional
buoyancy. That's right. So I know, 3D, I know it's lunchtime. I just want to say that there are people doing work on 3D now. And so Peter is one of them. And, you know, this is basically a model from some years ago now. I'm actually hoping that if we get to do a visualization demo on Thursday, we have this data set and we'll be able to play around with introducing streamlines and investigating it for yourself. So that'll be kind of a nice thing to do. And one thing you can see is that even in a 3D, they basically reproduce, they used a 3D spherical model to determine an estimate of the present day mantle convection flow, and then introduced based on density variations from tomography measurements and the sort of plate reconstructions, and then they introduced some particles here. And one thing you can see is, again, these very complicated structures and then some very simple structures embedded in them. And we're starting to see that as well. I'll actually just kind of end on this. This is a work by Farshad and Ricard in which they introduced a very simple flow, plate driven in a box, so it's kinematic, and found that, so it's just a box, there's a plate moving to the right and a plate moving to the left, and there's a little transform fault in between them. And so what you get here is basically they've drawn two particle paths there, a blue particle path and a red particle path, in the same flow. And depending on where you introduce the particle, you can get this very chaotic flow, or you can get this very simple closed flow. So you're getting the same sort of thing. Now, this is a kinematic model, and this is similar to, in a sense, similar to what Otina was doing, because it's driven kinematically. But they've been able to determine the relationship between the sort of the length of that transform fault versus the ridge and how it affects the development of these flows. And there are several methods, which I won't go into so that you can all go have lunch, for looking at them, one of which is looking at things like this, a cross-section. This sort of Poincaré cross-section essentially is a plane that's drawn through the middle of that box, and every time the path crosses the box, it leaves a point. So the blue curve, this is a way of getting beyond just looking at that tangle of spaghetti and looking at the at sort of where that path goes in here. It goes all around here and all around here, but it doesn't go into that red zone. And the red path is these loops here. That's where it crosses the middle of that box. And it does not go into the blue zone. So there's some isolation there going on. And so that's a similar kind of phenomenon. So I think I will leave it there and answer any questions. And thanks for your attention.